Hello and welcome to the Potential Psychology Podcast. I'm your host, Ellen Jackson, and it's my mission to share the science of human behaviour in a practical, fun, and inspiring way. In each podcast episode, I interview an expert from the fields of psychology, well-being, leadership, parenting, or high performance. I pick their brain to uncover what they know about living well, what tips do they have for you and I, and I quiz them about how they apply their expertise in their own life. Join me as we discover simple, science-backed ways to live, learn, flourish, and fulfill your potential. Hello, it's week 2 of our summer series of the Potential Psychology Podcast. Welcome back. It's so great to have you here over the next few weeks while the team and I have a short break and get started on some behind-the-scenes stuff to set up for our next super cool series of the show. We're revisiting some of our favourite past episodes. And today we're talking about one of my favourite topics, sleep. Now, you might be attempting what many of us attempt when we have holidays or a quieter period, and that's catching up on sleep. And you might be getting more sleep each night or deeper sleep, better sleep. Maybe there's a nap here and there. And that's great because sleep is important. In fact, we've discovered so much in the past 10 years or so about the health and well-being benefits of sleep that we didn't know earlier. And much of it suggests that many of us are at least mildly sleep deprived. And that really does increase our risk of disease, of accidents, and emotional ill health. My summer reading right now includes a book that came highly recommended by colleagues and past guests here on the show called Why We Sleep by Dr. Matthew Walker. And in it, he says that the silent sleep loss epidemic is one of the greatest public health challenges we face in the 21st century. And interestingly, of all the creatures in the animal kingdom, we humans are the only ones to deliberately deprive ourselves of sleep for no good reason. Now, I am passionate about the importance of sleep for our well-being, and I was intrigued to know a little more about it. So in season 4 of the show, I interviewed Dr. Kate Sprecher, who is a postdoctoral researcher in the Sleep and Chronobiology Lab at the University of Colorado, Boulder. And Kate and I explored the impact of our natural and unnatural environments on our sleep cycles, the role of sleep for the human body, from how we think and feel to the impact on our hormones and even deep down to our molecular level, and the simple strategies we can use to maximise the quality of our sleep for greater happiness and well-being amongst a host of other benefits. So let's listen in. Today we're talking about one of my favourite topics, sleep, and my guest is Dr. Kate Sprecher, and she's speaking to me from Boulder in Colorado in the United States, where it is currently still yesterday, because those time zone jokes never get old for me. And Kate's passion is understanding how sleep affects our physical and mental health, with her guiding question being, how can we get the best sleep possible? And she conducts and publishes research studies to understand better sleep. And she loves that her research is answering questions that are relevant to everyone's daily life, as do I. So I'm excited to have you here. Welcome, Kate.
Thanks for having me.
No problems at all. So you conduct research in a laboratory, and I'm going to ask you all about that in a moment because that's intriguing in itself. But first, I'd love to know, what led you to specialize in sleep? Where did this interest come from?
Well, it started when I was at uni doing my bachelor degree. We had to do a research project, and all of the projects on offer were sort of microbiology, sort of wet bench things, and I was a bit bored. And I thought, how can I do something with people? And I came across the sleep lab and I never left, basically.
That was it. So it started with it. So what was your undergrad degree? Where did you start?
It was in medical science at Flinders Uni in Adelaide.
Okay. Okay. So I can detect a really mixed accent there. How long have you been in the States?
Well, I've been in the States about 11 years, but growing up, I lived all over the world as well. So basically my accent has never quite settled into one thing. It just changes every year. So probably good for the listeners to know that so that they don't get distracted wondering where this accent comes from, because it doesn't come from anywhere.
It doesn't come from anywhere. It's a truly international accent, a little bit of everything. Mm-hmm. So you started in medical science here in Australia. And what happened next? Once you discovered this kind of interest in, accidentally discovered this interest in sleep?
Yeah, so I worked for a couple of years in Australia, in Adelaide, doing research on sleep apnea. And then I wanted to learn a little bit more about how to study brain activity during sleep. And I actually came to the States to do that. And I was working at the University of Wisconsin, looking at how sleep is related to things like schizophrenia, depression, and also getting a really detailed look at the brain activity that goes on during sleep. Because sleep isn't a time when your brain shuts down. It just does something different than when it's awake.
That is it. So what, I mean, I've sort of learnt bits and pieces as a psychologist over the years about the role of sleep for things like embedding memory and, you know, even kind of processing the day. That's a very non-scientific way of describing it. Can you tell us a little bit more about what does go on in terms of brain activity while we sleep?
Lots of things. So if anyone has seen EEG before, you'll know that your brain waves actually look very different when you're asleep compared to when you're awake, and they go through several different cycles of sleep, and each one seems to play a different role in terms of your cognitive function and also in terms of your physical function. So there's a lot of studies showing that when you're asleep, it's a time when your brain is doing a lot of repair processes at a molecular level. But then at this sort of broader level, when we talk about thinking, sleep is also a time when you're consolidating memories and sort of sorting out which things you want to remember and strengthening those and which things aren't important and basically forgetting those.
Okay. And of course, we have no control over that, do we?
Well, there are some technologies being developed to sort of boost some of those slow waves that are especially effective at boosting memory. They're still in development stages, but it will be interesting, especially for maybe applying to the field of Alzheimer's and dementia.
Oh, okay. So that's a form of, well, not so much preventative, but, and I don't want to use the word cure, but just to help perhaps people who are experiencing some decline. Would that be the aim?
Yes, that's the idea. It's still an active area of research, but there's been some promising results. So we're all quite hopeful that something will come of it.
Yeah, that is exciting. So how long, when would you say a kind of an interest in sleep has, you know, over what period has this boomed? Is this a relatively recent thing? I don't remember learning much about it when I did my original study, but that was 25 years ago now.
Yeah, the study of sleep as a science really is quite young compared to many other fields, and it really, really got going in the 60s. But I would say on a consumer level, it's really been just ballooning in the last 5 years or so, 5 or 10 years. Some of that is because of the rise of activity trackers. So lots of us have Fitbits, and they claim to tell us about our sleep. So suddenly we get quite curious about what that information really means and whether it's reliable. But along with that, now there's an increasing number of products out there that are claiming to either measure your sleep or help your sleep. I will say that many of them are questionable, but I welcome the interest that it's bringing. And I love that it's making people pay attention to sleep.
Yeah, and I suppose that's where it starts, doesn't it? And if there is interest from people, then, you know, you get funding, and funding leads to more research, et cetera, et cetera. But I do have one of those trackers. And it is interesting because I often wonder just how accurate is this? You know, is this actually telling me? Mine is very basic and tells me purportedly when I'm in a kind of a deep sleep and when I'm in lighter sleep. Now, it's only a thing on my wrist, so I can only assume that it's measuring how much I'm perhaps moving about or something. It hasn't got any access to anything else. So that does seem very basic and rudimentary, and I suspect not especially accurate. Would that be a correct assumption?
Yes. Yes. I think the value in the sleep trackers is really helping you to notice patterns over time. But they're not very accurate at estimating actual numbers of minutes that you've spent in a particular stage of sleep. But what they can be really helpful for is showing you patterns like, oh, I actually go to bed a lot later than I realized every night. Maybe I should pay attention to the clock a little bit more, or even set an alarm for bedtime, not just for wake time. So there is value, but we shouldn't get too hung up on the nitty-gritty details, especially one thing I really like to warn people away from is some of the products that claim to wake you up at your optimal point in the sleep cycle. Really, any app that is cutting your sleep shorter than you think you need is probably not doing you a favor. I'll put it that way.
I think that's a very diplomatic way to put it. Yeah, look, I've got a whole lot of questioning around that in a moment, which I'm going to come to. But what you're suggesting there, I guess, is, and I think this is one of the benefits, I suppose, of these trackers altogether, is it's not necessarily around the nitty gritty of the sleep part, but it's just that behavior, isn't it? Noticing the behavior, a bit like with your steps. You know, I often say, look, it doesn't really matter if I got 9,800 steps or I got 10,400 steps, or if I only got, it's knowing that some days maybe I've only got 3,000 steps and perhaps they're the days I need to get up and move around a little more.
Yeah, exactly. Yep.
So can you tell us a bit about the actual stages of sleep? I know I vaguely remember learning this once upon a time, and I think most of us have probably heard of REM sleep and non-REM sleep, but I can't remember the detail of what these mean, and perhaps those things are outdated now. What's the latest on stages?
Well, no, those things have been pretty stable. And it's true that most medical and health professionals don't get a lot of sleep education. So don't feel bad. So the sleep cycles, basically across the course of the night, you cycle through several stages of sleep and you complete a full cycle every 90 minutes, roughly. And you start off in a very shallow stage called stage one. They've got very imaginative names, numbers. And you're usually only in that for a couple of minutes. And then you end up in a stage called stage two. And there's some very interesting brain activity that goes along with that. For those who are really interested in the details, you get these little bursts of activity called spindles and K complexes, and they seem to be really important for memory. When you don't have enough of them, you definitely show trouble with memory the next day.
Okay, interesting.
And then you go into the deep stage of sleep called stage three, and it's called deep because it's the hardest stage to wake you up from. And if you are woken up from that stage, you feel really groggy. And that stage, basically, your whole brain starts to, all of your neurons start to fire together in this synchronous activity. And that's where you're doing a lot of the work of sort of repair, laying down memories, and really making important changes, even at a molecular level in the brain. And then you go into REM sleep, so rapid eye movement sleep, which a lot of us have heard of as being associated with dreaming. So that's true. REM sleep is when you tend to get your sort of vivid dreams where you feel like you're having a full-blown experience, a story. But you can actually dream in other stages of sleep, but it tends to be more sort of impressions and just sort of vague feelings, sort of visualizations, but not those full-blown sort of story experiences.
Narrative kind of, yeah.
Exactly. Yep. Yeah, and we think that REM is really important for emotional memory. But, of course, you need a little bit of every stage of sleep in their appropriate proportion. Mm. Basically, what happens is after the end of a REM period, you just bump back up to stage one and then start cycling through again.
Okay. So I think any of us who have lived in a house with infant children would know the impact that having disrupted sleep can have on us. But what are the other implications if you're not getting an adequate amount? And firstly, what would be an adequate amount of sleep, say, for the average adult?
So that's really the golden question. And I hate to give a number because it's just one number and people are different. But there has actually been a consensus statement by the American Academy of Sleep Medicine where they assessed all of the available literature and came up with the number 7. So basically, it seems that if you get less than 7 hours of sleep, most people show negative impacts on health, cognition, mood, But that's not to say that there aren't exceptions. So there are very, very rare people who need less than that. There are many people who get less than that, but but it's pretty rare that a person can get less than 7 hours and actually be functioning optimally. And many of us need more than that. So I personally know that I need 8 hours. And if I don't get it, I just feel awful. And really the best way to figure it out is it is personal. The best thing to do is to spend a week sleeping as much as you need to when you need to. And hopefully you'll fall into a pretty regular rhythm by the end of a week or two. And that's the amount of sleep that you need.
Okay, interesting. So if you actually have the opportunity to kind of do a little, I suppose, bit of self-experimentation. So this is, I presume, not setting alarms, going to bed when you feel tired, and just allowing yourself to, does that include naps during the day or is this only sleep at night?
Well, the recommendation generally is not to nap. But again, there is some individual variation. So some people are going to be fine with napping. The issue generally is that if you nap, you might have trouble falling asleep at night because your need for sleep basically builds up the longer you're awake. And if you don't have enough sleep pressure pushing you into sleep, you might find it hard to fall asleep. So that can be a really tricky cycle for people with insomnia, for example. They don't sleep at night. And then during the day, they're able to fall asleep and they feel very tired. So they have a nap because that makes them feel better in the moment. But then it just leads to this negative cycle where they just can't fall asleep at night again. So one of the treatments for insomnia actually involves sleep deprivation, surprisingly.
Okay.
And helping people to build up that sleep pressure again.
So forcing you into a better pattern. And going back to your point about that, I like that term sleep pressure because I think, again, anyone who's had kids who has had that experience of the toddler or young child falling asleep at sort of 5 p.m. and sleeping for a good portion and then you just know you're never going to get them to bed on time and it messes everything up again.
Yes, and that's a situation where I say, you know, we've got all these ideals about how you can get your optimal sleep, but also just be realistic about the phase of life that you're in. And, you know, it may be that that's just temporarily going to have to be your life.
And it does get better. It may not feel like it's going to get better, but it does get better. Okay, I'm interested because you mentioned before about this, you know, the suggestion of technology that could wake you up potentially at this optimal time. And I know that there is certainly in the kind of media and entrepreneurial press, there's always discussion about how everyone should be getting up at 4 a.m. because that's the best time to get the most done. And I'm personally, although again, I'll ask you about this in a moment, I personally believe A, I need a lot of sleep and B, I'm not really a morning person. So the idea of waking myself up or having something that wakes me up at 4 a.m. to try and get more done just feels like anathema to me. So, I mean, is there something in this? You said there's personal variation, so maybe this does work for some people, but is it really a good recommendation for everybody?
No, there's definitely something to that. So I talked about sleep pressure sort of building up across the day. So the longer you're awake, the more you need to sleep. I think that's pretty straightforward. But there's more to it than that, and the most obvious example is jet lag. So if you've ever traveled somewhere, you've been awake for hours, but you've shown up in a new time zone, you try to go to bed at what is now your new midnight, and you can't fall asleep. So obviously there's more going on than just sleep pressure, and that's your circadian rhythm. So a lot of people know a little bit about circadian rhythms. It's basically the idea that our bodies are in tune with our light-dark cycle. So we live on a planet that rotates and we see a 24-hour cycle in the sunlight. And our bodies are primed to sleep when it's dark and be awake when it's light. And that is basically what shapes when we can fall asleep. And some people are night owls and some people are morning larks. And that is to do with when your body's rhythm is timed in relation to the sun. So you can push it around a little bit with the lights that you have in your home. Some of us do that accidentally by reading on the laptop late at night, and we are essentially extending the length of daylight that we're exposed to. But you can also do it the other way around and turn the lights on in the morning and sort of push yourself into being a little bit more of a morning person. But there are, it's difficult. If you're naturally wanting to wake up at 10 a.m., you can't expect that within a couple of days of turning the lights on in the morning that you'll suddenly be wide awake at 4 a.m. That's just unrealistic. But you can do it gradually.
But how much could you shift that by? If you were someone whose body naturally wanted to wake up at 10 a.m., which sounds glorious to me, but it's never going to happen. Can you become someone who would then be okay waking up, say, I mean, I know shift workers and lots of people have to do this, but I'm wondering how kind of natural it is for your body, or whether it really, whether it has long-term implications or really messes you around.
So the challenge is being able to control your light exposure. So people who've traveled across the world, you know, and done a full 12-hour shift and eventually adapted, they have shifted. But that's because their light cycle has also completely changed. Mm-hmm. So there's no limit to how far you can shift, except that it's really hard to actually control light. So shift workers, for example, when they drive home in the morning, they're usually getting a big blast of light, which is what they would like their body to think is evening, but they're getting a huge blast of light. So that's
okay. Really, so even if you went home then and tried to go to sleep, your body's kind of going, no, but hang on, you've had light, it's daytime, you can't be sleeping now. It's like your body's saying, but it's midday, even if it's not.
Exactly. But, you know, I have this great little alarm clock that I use because I'm not an early morning person, but I like to align my sleep with my social and work obligations a little bit more than I naturally am. So I have this great alarm clock that actually starts turning on a light about half an hour before the alarm rings.
And it
helps me wake up a little more. And it also kind of acts as a timekeeper that sort of keeps me as a slightly earlier morning person than I would naturally be.
Interesting. I think I need one of those alarm
clocks. Very nice.
And I'm thinking too, because obviously, you know, summer and winter make a difference, and depending a little bit on where you are. So I'm in Ballarat and Victoria in Australia. So we're sort of, you know, fairly far south, and we get more the extreme. Say, I used to live in Sydney. I even noticed the difference then that our daylight lasts longer in summer further south than it did even just that 1,000 kilometres away. So, and winter is cold and dark. Mm-hmm. not by the standards that you live in now, by any stretch. You know, we're still talking very temperate Australian conditions, but having to wake up at the same time all year, because you do, you know, like you say, your social and your life obligations require you to get up pretty consistently all year. So that's an interesting idea, that just by gently altering those conditions, we can help ourselves a little bit.
Yeah, so you can use sort of blackout curtains in the summer and then use these timed lights in the winter. Manipulate the day length basically to your advantage.
Yeah, how interesting. So you talked before about the fact that there is some individual variation in this. So we're you know, as human beings, as a big group, we operate on these 24-hour circadian rhythms and we're aligned to, you know, the globe, the world. Those light patterns, but there is some individual variation in that. Now, that is what we call a chronotype, is it?
Yes, exactly.
And what do we know about chronotypes and how much variation there might be?
So there's a couple of ways of defining chronotype. One is just based on your behavior. So when do you typically sleep? And some of us typically sleep later, night owls. Some of us typically wake up earlier, morning larks, or somewhere in between. But there's another way of defining chronotype, which is based on your biology. And the main marker that is used for that is melatonin. So melatonin is released during the night and is suppressed during the day by light. And so the timing of that melatonin rhythm basically is another way of defining your chronotype. So if your body naturally starts to release melatonin early in the evening, that means that you're going to get sleepy early in the evening. So there is a biological basis to these things.
Okay, interesting. And how do you actually assess this? What is the melatonin assessed through blood tests?
So it's a little bit tricky to do at home because light suppresses melatonin. Mm-hmm. So you have to measure it in dim light conditions, mm-hmm. so really dim light. So typically it's done in a laboratory and you might take saliva samples or blood samples every half hour to an hour. And if you want to get the full 24-hour rhythm, you're going to have to be in the lab for at least 24 hours, usually 36, just to make sure that we don't miss a little bit at the beginning or end.
Okay.
It can be done in the home, but that means, again, that you would need to block out all the lights. But there are kits that can be used for that, usually just by researchers, though.
Okay. But probably easier to do what you suggested before, which is just allow yourself to go to sleep and just kind of look for patterns and timing yeah. without having to get into that biological detail.
Well, see, that's an area of really active research because we would love to be able to take a single blood sample, for example, and tell what your biological time is, your internal time, because it does have a big impact on a lot of different aspects of health, not just sleep, but many other processes in your body are on that circadian cycle. So there's an enormous amount of research being put into it because right now the main barrier is that it is so difficult. You have to come into the lab for hours and hours. It's just not practical. But if we can develop a single blood test, that would just open up so many doors for healthcare that it could have a really big impact. So we're all very hopeful that maybe in the next same scientific timelines, let's say 5 or 10 years, we might have something.
So what are some of, because I was going to ask you what, you know, we talked a bit about some of the processes associated with sleep, the things that it's important for from a general health and well-being point of view. Why do we need good sleep?
Yeah, so there's a lot there. So there's some really basic functions that are regulated by sleep. So if you are sleep deprived, you're not going to think as well, but you also disrupt a lot of hormones that control how hungry you are and how you metabolize your food. So being sleep deprived can actually lead to obesity and the risk of heart disease and other sort of cardiovascular diseases. Sleep deprivation or sleeping too little, not being sleep deprived, just sleeping too little, has also been associated with cancer, with many other diseases. And some of the research that I've been doing over the last few years has been looking at the link between poor sleep and Alzheimer's disease and the risk of developing dementia.
And what have your findings been so far?
Well, there's certainly a link there. What we're still trying to understand is whether Alzheimer's disease impairs your ability to get good sleep or whether sleeping poorly increases your risk of Alzheimer's.
Contributing, and okay.
The evidence is probably that both are happening.
Okay. Helpful, not helpful.
Yes. Well, the encouraging part is that means if we improve our sleep, we might be able to improve our risk of dementia.
So a whole lot of physical, I mean, it's obviously far more significant to our health. And I know as a psychologist, the role of sleep, not necessarily at the scientific level, but just from an observational level in things like mood regulation and our ability to maintain a more equal mood and not be losing the plot and getting cranky with people and snappy and all of those sorts, or teary or whatever it might be, that's sort of vital. So it's so fundamental to so many things and we're discovering so much more about it. What do we need to do to get better sleep? You suggested that most of us need about 7 hours, but I know as well as you do, because I quite often ask people in workshops and we talk about sleep in relation to well-being, and I'll actually go to people and say, how many people here get 8 hours of sleep per night? And I might have a room of, 20 people, and I'll have a couple of people put their hands up, and then I go down and say 7, 6, 5. And I'm always astounded because I will have people who put their hand up and say, I regularly only get 3 to 4 hours of good sleep. Mm. I'm like, my God, how are you even alive and functioning?
Yes.
but clearly they are, but perhaps, you know, perhaps not functioning well. What do we need to do to change this?
Well, this is the part of the talk that I love, because there are lots of things that are not difficult that can make a really big difference. It just requires acknowledging that it's important and really giving it some dedication. So one of the most important things, like you said, is getting enough sleep, but also getting it on a regular schedule is really helpful because of those circadian rhythms. So you want to keep your light cycle, your light-dark patterns pretty regular.
Yep.
So some basic tips that people might find useful are just to make your bedroom a relaxing space. Ideally, keep the TV in a different room and make your bed just for sleeping. That really helps with falling asleep and staying asleep. So, you know, keep it at a comfortable temperature, keep it quiet, keep it dark. Another important thing is caffeine and alcohol. And I think a lot of these things are things that we all know, but we tend to ignore. But coffee obviously has a big impact on your ability to sleep. The half-life of caffeine is about 12 hours. So basically, after you drink caffeine, it takes 12 hours to reach half of its effect. So that means that it's still having a big impact on your sleep.
Yep.
And alcohol, a lot of people think of nightcaps as being useful, but alcohol can help you fall asleep, but it tends to disturb your sleep later in the night. So you tend to be more restless after alcohol. And cigarettes are stimulants, so nicotine also is not going to help. So ideally cutting those things out several hours before bed is helpful. And getting regular exercise is really helpful. Some people are going to be okay exercising in the evenings. Others, it will wake you up too much. That's definitely something you just have to experiment with and figure out for yourself. Quite a few different things that we can do that really make a big difference.
What about stress and worry? Because I know that's something that, I mean, again, as a psychologist, but a lot of people report that having things on their mind makes it difficult to sleep.
Yeah. So the first thing I will say is, if you think you have insomnia, the best thing that you can do is go and talk to a professional who has training in sleep, because there are many, many things that can contribute to insomnia. Many solvable things that contribute to insomnia. So that's the first thing I'll say before I give my tips. And I'm not a medical professional. I'm a researcher. So I'll just tell you what I've gleaned.
Before you do that, who would you go and see? If you're going to see, so do you see a GP? Are there actual kind of sleep specialists within the medical field? I'm fairly confident there are.
There are, yes. Yeah. So there are sleep clinics within hospitals and independently. Many people go to them to get diagnosed with things like sleep apnea, but they also have a lot of training and expertise in insomnia. And often they will have a mental health professional who there has training in, there's a lot of specialized programs for insomnia and sleep.
Excellent. So now, yes, your tips, please.
Oh, yes. Okay. So one of the big tips is to not stay in bed ruminating. So basically, if you are awake for more than 20 minutes in the middle of the night, the best thing to do is to get up and go do something else for a while until you feel sleepy and ready to try and sleep again. Obviously, don't go read with really bright lights or do anything super exciting. You want to stay calm, but don't lie in bed for hours restless. If you're not sleeping, just get up and do something else. Now, that could mean that for several days in a row, you're getting up for a while in the night and not being able to sleep for very long. But it's really important that you keep your bedtime and your wake time consistent, and eventually you'll build up that sleep pressure that will help you fall asleep and stay asleep.
Excellent. Okay. That's so you have to be, there's a little bit of patience required.
Yes. And there are approaches that use sleep deprivation or sleep restriction also, so just sleeping very short amounts in the night, those I would recommend getting advice on before you just try to do it yourself, because there's a whole lot of stuff that goes along with that protocol that really helps tailor it to your lifestyle and your needs.
So seek a bit of professional help if you're looking at that kind of sleep deprivation or sleep restriction approach. Mm-hmm. Any other, I mean, I know one thing that, and this is just born of personal experience, because I used to keep my mobile phone in my bedroom and I did have the occasion where I would do that kind of 3 o'clock in the morning, wake up, something on my mind, and I'd reach for the phone. And then I discovered that I'd basically spent 2 hours disappearing down some kind of social media rabbit hole, which is clearly not helping me get back to sleep. So I now make sure that my phone is charging in a separate room, not in my bedroom. I've gone back to the old fashioned alarm clock. Is that a trap for a lot of people?
Yeah, that's really common, especially teenagers, because there's a lot of social pressure to respond as quickly as possible to any sort of, especially social media. So keeping the phone out of the bedroom, or at the very least out of reach, is a really good idea. On silent, on airplane mode even, or completely turned off if you can manage. that's a really, really good idea. Yes.
Okay.
It's not just waking you up because of what you're reading, but also the light coming off of the screen.
Yeah.
And there are, you know, there's things like night shift mode now that helps reduce some of that, but it's not cutting everything out. So it's still sort of stimulating that circadian system and telling your body that it's daytime.
So better just to cut it out altogether.
Exactly. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, and some people, you know, I think you would be more qualified than I am to say that, you know, some people recommend journaling in the evening before sleep, or anything that you think might keep you awake, just get it written down somewhere so that you can deal with it tomorrow when you're awake.
Mm-hmm. Yep, absolutely. Meditation and a bit of a mindfulness. I know I use that myself, even just those kind of body scan relaxation type exercises to get the brain a little more peaceful, the mind a little more peaceful.
Those are really great. Routines are really fantastic. A bedtime routine.
Yeah, look, that's an interesting one, isn't it? Because it's something that we think about for children, especially little children, you know, having that, I think probably because we're all just desperate to make them sleep, so we'll do anything. So, you know, having those routines of a bath and a bedtime story, or and consistent bedtimes, et cetera. But we seem to forget those sorts of behaviours, or perhaps a need for those, or we underestimate the need for those when we're adults.
Yeah, they can be really helpful.
And I think too, because one of the things that I know I've had people report, especially I suppose younger people, perhaps in their early 20s, who have this kind of, I'll just catch up on sleep on the weekend. So I might go hard, and whether that's going hard at work or whether it's going hard with your social life, you know, I'll struggle through the week on minimal sleep and then I'll catch up on the weekend. But is that a useful strategy?
It pains me to say, but no, unfortunately. Some research that was done by my colleagues in the lab I'm currently working in basically shows that weekend recovery sleep is not sufficient. You don't truly recover on a metabolic level or on a cognitive level. And what's even more worrying is in some cases, it seems like it could actually be worse for you. So I would like to say that getting more sleep is always better, but having regular sleep is so important. And part of that is that you have circadian rhythms generated by every cell in your body. And normally they are all synchronized by the brain, which is synchronized to the light that it's exposed to through your eyes. But what can happen is all of those cells, the little clocks in every cell, can get out of time with each other. And if you're sort of eating at a weird time, you might be signaling to your digestive system in a different timing than you're signaling to other parts of your physiology. And so then everything isn't sort of optimally primed to work together anymore. It's sort of all a bit disorganized, and that can lead to health problems as well. So that's something that we're just learning about now, but it can
happen. Yeah, interesting. Having that kebab at 2 a.m. as you walk home after being tired out is just confusing the whole system. It doesn't know whether it's breakfast, lunch, dinner, what's going on.
Absolutely. So once in a while, we all need some fun, but mostly a regular schedule is going to be really helpful.
Yeah. And I suppose because your body doesn't know if it's Wednesday or Saturday or Sunday, or, you know, it's just a 24-hour thing, isn't it? So it has to, you have to stick with that. Boring, but important. Kate, so I'm just interested to know, I mean, I could ask you 1,000 questions, but we don't have all day. I'm interested to know, so you work in a lab, you're doing this research. Who are the people who come in and participate in your research? And what are the implications, I suppose? Because one of the things that I always often think of, you know, when you're going off, if you're going to a sleep clinic or doing anything like this, is that surely it's impossible to get to sleep if you're lying in a laboratory with things stuck to your head and, you know, electrodes and all of that. How do you manage that side of things?
Well, sleep is a powerful need. So you'd be amazed what people can sleep through. And especially the studies that I'm currently doing, we're recruiting healthy people with very healthy sleep. And so they really have no trouble falling asleep. And we actually do a surprisingly good job of attaching all of these sensors and bundling them out of the way. So that's not been an issue too much. I've also done quite a bit of research having patients come in. So patients with sleep apnea, for example, or patients who are developing dementia. And even they are able to sleep in the lab because we're not recruiting people with insomnia in my research. Those are the folks who have a hard time. But otherwise, you know, sleep pressure builds up and you fall asleep.
Definitely. And I'm assuming when we talk, I mean, because when we use the word lab, I think most of us think, you know, white clinical bright lights. I'm assuming that it looks nothing like that.
Yes. Yeah, so we try to keep it as comfortable as possible. So I've worked in a few different labs and one of them looked really just like a nice hotel. You had a nice little cupboard in the corner to hang your coat and lovely bedspreads and things. The lab that I'm in right now, we have to do a little bit more control of the environment. So it's a little bit more clinical looking, but it's still a nice comfy bed and a blanket, and we turn off the lights for you and we try to keep things as comfortable as possible.
Which makes sense.
Yes, exactly. We want people to sleep.
You do, don't you? It's no good if people just lie there wide awake the whole time. You won't learn anything.
Exactly.
Kate, you've given us some fabulous tips, and that's been even just helpful to me, and I know helpful to certainly family members of mine who I know don't sleep particularly well. Are there other resources, things that you think, because I believe you have a passion for getting more of this information out there to everybody because you fully understand what the health and wellbeing implications are, and obviously we're learning all the time. So are there other resources or things that people can look up or watch or find, books that they can read that we can send them to so that they can learn a little bit more about how to get the best sleep possible?
Yeah, absolutely. So I will first put in another plug for seeing
a
sleep professional if you are concerned about your sleep, because there's a lot of things that can be fixed and a professional is well trained to recognize what those might be. But if you want to learn more, one great resource is the Sleep Health Foundation. It's an Australian group. So sleephealthfoundation.org.au has all kinds of information sheets. They organize events. They're based in New South Wales, but they serve the whole of Australia. I really encourage looking them up. And if you want to just some interesting reading on the science of sleep, there's a great new book that came out by Dr. Matt Walker. He's a professor at UC Berkeley, and he wrote a book called Why We Sleep. And that talks a lot about the research and the science behind sleep, but also has some really useful tips on what good sleep looks like and how you can get it.
I think I've had colleagues recommend that one to me. I think they've read it over our summer and said, get hold of this book. It's great. So yes. Okay. We'll pop that in the show notes.
And then one more that I'll mention, it's called Project Sleep. And this is a really lovely advocacy project that started a couple of years ago here in the US and it's now international. And it's especially focused on people who have rare sleep disorders like narcolepsy that are very poorly understood. And it has a series of videos of people who've been diagnosed with narcolepsy sharing their experiences. And even if that's not you, it's a really fascinating group of videos to watch and realize narcolepsy, a lot of us have this stereotype of comical characters falling asleep in the middle of a conversation. But there's a lot more to the disease, and it's a really interesting thing to learn about just in terms of the science. But also this project is doing a great job of shedding light on these poorly misunderstood diseases.
Okay. So, yeah, I mean, like I said, there's so many other questions I could ask you, because there's so many other aspects to sleep that we probably don't think about. I think narcolepsy is a really great point. And I know we mentioned shift workers earlier, and people who, because that is such a common experience for so many people, and yet clearly has really disruptive effects on our sleep. So another one that I could ask you a lot more about, but don't have time today, unfortunately. Do you know of any resources that are great to help people understand sleep in relation to shift work? Is that something that the Sleep Health Foundation might provide more information on?
Yes, I think the Sleep Health Foundation has some information, and there's also a Sleep Health Foundation in the United States, and their website has a lot of helpful information as well. Mm. Things like how to manage your sleep if you are scheduled on night shifts and that sort of thing. Yes, unfortunately, shift work is never going away, so we just have to learn how to operate with it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, you're right. And so many different impacts of sleep on our work life. Again, another conversation that we could have maybe for another time is, you know, what we've learned about sleep and what the implications are for the way we work, the way we go to school, all of those sorts of things. So we might just have to get you back on the show to discuss that at some point.
Sounds great.
But today, Kate, thank you very much. I've learned so much already, and I already had kind of an interest in sleep. So you've educated me further. I hope all our listeners have discovered something perhaps about sleep and their well-being that they didn't know before, and probably more importantly, have some practical tips for how to get better sleep, or at least, I suppose, appreciate the importance of it for us in terms of getting good and regular sleep.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me, and everybody, sleep is good for you, so go get some.
Excellent. I'm going to do that tonight, having not slept that well this week. I'm going to go and implement some of these tips straight away. Kate, thank you once again.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for revisiting this episode with me. I hope it has inspired you to really focus on your sleep habits for 2020 and beyond. Because imagine if we all got better sleep, how much greater and happier might the world be? You'll find the links to the resources that Kate and I mentioned in this episode in the show notes at potential.com.au/podcast. There's also a link to Dr. Matthew Walker's book, Why We Sleep, and his TED Talk from last year, which is Sleep is Your Superpower. If you are still contemplating your goals and personal projects for 2020, and maybe sleep is one of them, better sleep, don't forget to sign up to our mailing list to get a copy of my 2020 personal projects planner. You can do that at potential.com.au/subscribe, or follow the link in the show notes. And let me know what you're planning for 2020. Pop a picture up in your social feed and tag it Potential Psychology, or share it in the Potential Psychology Podcast Facebook group. Shared support from your community goes a long way to helping us all to sustain motivation and achieve our goals. Now, next week in our summer series, we're revisiting Professor Lee Waters' refreshing, fun and positive take on kids and parenting with flipping the switch to positive parenting. And in this episode, Lee and I explore strengths-based parenting. So what are strengths and how do you identify them in your child? The benefit of strengths-based parenting for parents, why we default to finding weakness rather than strength, and how to counteract this, and stopping the cycle of criticism and the benefits of a strength-based approach, particularly for teens. We're also going to discuss how to create harmony at home and some practical strategies for building a strengths-based approach in your family. It's one of my absolute favourite episodes, as Lee not only shares the science, but also her personal experiences. And she's just delightful to talk to. So that's next week in our summer series of the Potential Psychology Podcast. Until then, don't forget to send me pictures of your personal project planner in action. If you don't have a copy yet, you can get a hold of one, I'll send it through to you. Just pop your details in at potential.com.au/subscribe and share with me and the community what you're working towards in 2020. But in the meantime, go forth, thrive, flourish, and fulfill your potential.